So today, the idea is that we're going to cover at least part of Hebrews chapter 11. And so the kind of plan that I'd like for us to do today is, first of all, go back and review a little bit of what we've been, what you have been looking at in Hebrews. And then I want to turn a focus, actually, to chapter 11, verses 1 through 22. And the idea is that we'll maybe get through about half of the chapter, and then on Wednesday, Steve can go back and fix everything that, maybe go back and review a little bit and then continue on with chapter 11. And then as we focus on that, we kind of want to end with, what does this really mean for me? How does Hebrews chapter 11 really change me? So, first of all, what would you say, and what, as you have studied, what is the theme of the book of Hebrews? If you could sum it up and encapsulate it in one sentence, Hebrews is about... All right, the new covenant is better. I heard some other responses back here. All right, Jesus is better. All right, any other thoughts that we might add to that? All right, pretty well sums it up. And I would say as well, Jesus is better. This is the theme of Hebrews, all right? And so as we go through the book and as you study the different comparisons that Jesus and the new covenant and being compared to the old, you see that the new is superior. So for example, in chapters 1 and 2, what do we see? What comparison do we see? All right, Jesus is greater than the angels. And chapter 2 also picks up the question, well, if he is greater than the angels, why did he lower himself to be a man? And there the response is, he had to die. All right, he needed the physical body so that he could be that sacrifice. Chapter 3, Jesus is greater than Moses. Moses was a steward or a servant in the house of God. Jesus is the son in the house of his father, who is a faithful servant. Chapter 4, Jesus' rest and his conquest is better than that of Joshua's. Chapters 5 through 7, the priesthood of Jesus is superior to that priesthood of Aaron. And some of the comparisons made here, Aaron's priesthood was through the tribe of Levi and Aaron's descendants. Jesus' priesthood is after what pattern? The order of Melchizedek. Now, what's crucial about Melchizedek and his role that distinguishes him from Aaron's priesthood? All right, it wasn't Levitical. What else? All right, we have a priest that he's chosen by God. Other things? All right, priest and king. All right, very good. All right, so Jesus serves that dual role as priest and king. Then as we move forward to chapter 8, we have a better covenant. He compares it with Jeremiah chapter 31, verses 31 through 34, where the Lord already prophesied that there would come something that is new and would replace the old, and now that which is old and obsolete is passing away. Chapter 9, there's a better tabernacle, or that is a better temple, better dwelling place for God in the new covenant. And then in chapter 10, the first half of the chapter, he focuses on the nature of sacrifice. The blood of bulls and goats can't take away sin, and so Jesus comes and he presents his body as this sacrifice to the Lord. And then the big transition then in the book of Hebrews takes place there in verse 19, where the rest of the book really could be summed up. Now that this has been established, hold fast to what you have. Hold fast your confession to the end. Now, as we go back and kind of maybe focus a little bit more on that review of chapter 10, it's important so that we get that running start into chapter 11, because it's related. So as we look at the end of chapter 10, how does God expect his people to, in part, accomplish that goal of holding fast? How do we maintain that kind of commitment to the Lord? He actually gives the mechanism or the means by which we do that. All right, very good. We ourselves, in a sense, God's people police themselves. We encourage one another. And the idea is that just as in the Old Testament, the congregation was to maintain holiness in the camp, even so we in the great camp of God, spiritual Israel, we are to encourage one another, stir each other up to love and good works. He ends the chapter then with different kinds of motivation for why they should do that. If you neglect this new covenant and you think that going back to the old law is going to be what will work for you, he says, you are crucifying anew the Son of God. And so he gives that kind of negative motivation, but toward the end of the chapter, he transitions to say, but you've already suffered through somewhat. You have shown commitment and dedication up to a degree, so keep that up. And so there's a sense of the motivation of, now I'm warning you, but there's also, you can do it and you have proven that. And this is truly where all of our motivation should ultimately lie. There's the warning, but there's also the positive encouragement as well. And so notice then, as we begin to transition specifically into chapter 11, notice at the end he has quoted the book of Habakkuk about the just living by faith, but don't draw back. Maintain your faith and sustain that. And he ends in verse 39, but we are not of those who draw back to perdition, but of those who believe to the saving of the soul. And now what he's about to do in chapter 11, let me tell you about a group of people, a crowd of witnesses that did not draw back, but they believed to the saving of the soul. Faith is that theme that carries chapter 10 into chapter 11. And so certainly, I think probably, Hebrews chapter 11 is one of the most well-known passages in the New Testament. And so what I'd like for us to do is to take our time going through these first 22 verses and to contemplate how that message fits in to the overall purpose of Hebrews. And as I said, we close on how that can change us. I want to go back, and I'm sure that you have discussed this multiple times throughout, but I think especially with chapter 11, is this important to understand the audience, those to whom Hebrews is especially addressed. He's writing to Christians, but those who had been Jewish Christians. And the idea is that they have come out of Judaism, they've been converted to Christ, and there exists the threat that they would return back to their old ways, to the ways of the Jewish faith. And there's a constant reminder of, don't do that, what you have is better. But you could certainly imagine the kind of appeal that maybe some of their family members or some of their former associates would make to draw them back into their former way to abandon Christ. And you could imagine there are a series of arguments that you just expect that their associates would make. Why have you left the real temple? And I assume Hebrews was written before the destruction in 70. Why would you abandon the real temple, the physical temple, for what? This spiritual thing you speak of? Look, our fathers were at physical Mount Sinai. Why would you leave that? Ten Commandments, a temple, the real priesthood. Here is Jerusalem. And the idea here is, here are things that you can see. It's tangible. Why would you leave that which you see and is tangible for something that is non-tangible, something that you cannot see? And I think the appeal in chapter 11 is, he's already gone through the work of establishing through Scripture what they should believe. But in chapter 11, he drives to the heart. And he assails the emotions of those who might want to go back. If you go back, do you understand you are leaving Abraham? You are leaving Moses. You're leaving the fathers. All the prophets worked for, you're just going to abandon that for this new covenant? And so the writer here is making the point, if you truly want to follow in the footsteps of Noah and Abraham and of Moses and David and the fathers, then you will follow through and complete the work that they began. Stick with it, because that's what they did. That's what they would do if they were alive at this time. And so with that kind of context then, let's go ahead and move now into chapter 11. And what I'll do is we'll read a section by section, make comment on it, and then move on. So let's begin by reading chapter 11, verses 1 through 7, which talk about the pre-patriarchal fathers. So chapter 11, verse 1. Now, faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. For by it the elders obtained a good testimony. By faith we understand that the worlds were framed by the word of God, so that the things which are seen were not made of things which are visible. By faith, Abel offered to God a more excellent sacrifice than Cain, through which he obtained witness that he was righteous, God testifying of his gifts, and through it, he being dead still speaks. By faith, Enoch was taken away so that he did not see death, and was not found because God had taken him. For before he was taken, he had this testimony that he pleased God. But without faith, it is impossible to please him. For he who comes to God must believe that he is, and that he is a rewarder of those who diligently seek him. By faith, Noah, being divinely warned of things not yet seen, moved with godly fear, prepared an ark for the saving of his household, by which he condemned the world and became heir of the righteousness which is according to faith. So in this first section, he begins by saying, I want to tell you about faith and how faith acts. Now, I take it in verse 1 that he is not seeking to provide for us a definition of what faith is. It's more of a description of what faith does. I think the idea here is when he said, faith is the substance or that which undergirds and supports things that are hoped for. Faith grasps the evidence and it realizes the evidence of the things you don't see with the unaided eye. And the idea here is, just like we might give a description of someone without it being a definition of them, all right? So I might say, for example, Solomon is wise. This isn't the definition of who Solomon is or what he is. It describes him, an aspect of his character, and somewhat of what you might expect. And so here's a description of what faith does. Faith is that which grasps hold of that which we cannot see, and it makes it real for us, and it makes it so real that it impels our actions. Go on to see in verse 2, it is through faith that the elders obtain a good testimony. Now, connect this for a moment with what you know of the book of Galatians especially and the book of Romans. Connect verse 2 with that. What do you think the author of Hebrews is stressing here? It is by it the elders obtain a good testimony. So in view of those two letters and their point, their objective, how would you maybe summarize in a different way verse 2? Sorry, what's that? Okay, how does God's approval come? Right, by faith. In Galatians and Romans, he's saying God's approval, his acceptance, is not through the law of Moses. That existed for a time, but this is not salvation. And now he is saying, I think, stressing here, what obtained a good testimony for our fathers? It wasn't because of their physical lineage. It wasn't because of their adherence to the law. More specifically, what obtained them a good testimony or record before God? Their faith. And he gives an example of the power of faith in seeing that which is unseeable. In verse 3, the reference about the world's being framed by the word of God. So he takes us back to a moment that none of us could see, none of us could experience. And he's saying, you hold that to be evident and true, and you have built your lives around this proposition of God as creator. And so he is saying, be consistent and now follow through on what we believe about that beginning. So with that said, we'll now jump into, especially in verses 4 and following, the different records of the fathers who obtained that good testimony. So before we do that, however, questions or comments anyone would like to offer? If I could see a hand, just to make this a little bit orderly. Any questions or comments you'd like to make? You can't comment on verses 1 through 3 anymore after this. Just want to warn you, okay? All right. I was just making sure. Okay. Well, let's get into verse 4 then. So here we have, first of all, Abel. And of course, we know back in Genesis chapter 4, we have the story of Cain. And Cain brought of the fruit of the ground, and his offering was rejected by the Lord. Abel brings of his flocks and herds, and his offering is accepted by the Lord. And here in verse 4, the focus is on Abel's faith drove him to offer the more excellent sacrifice. And it is in that act of that sacrifice that he obtains the witness of God that he was righteous. I want to focus, however, at the end in verse 4. And through it, he being dead still speaks. A couple of questions about this. through it or by means of it. What is it in this context? Okay, through faith, by means of faith, he being dead still speaks. Not my faith, through Abel's faith. The ramifications or the consequences of his decisions follow through for eternity. And now I want to ask the second question, if he being dead still speaks, what is he saying? Because you look through Hebrews and the idea of speaking is a theme that runs from verse 1 all the way toward the end of the book. And it really climaxes in chapter 12, as you will see in a couple of weeks. Don't refuse him who speaks. All right, so the idea of speaking runs throughout this letter. Now then, giving you a little bit of time to dwell on it more. Abel, through it, still speaks. What does he say? Right. The idea here is that I think Cain and Abel really stand as almost representative of humanity. Right? I'm not saying that this is like an analogy that wasn't historical, but the point I'm making is they kind of represent for us. We all have the opportunity to offer gifts to God, and we can walk by sight or we can walk by faith as Abel did. That it is possible to achieve the standing before God as righteous. And the idea that I can be acceptable and pleasing to him. Any other comments on that point before we proceed? Correct. And just to summarize the comment for everyone else, yeah, we don't know the specific of the details about maybe specifically what it was about these sacrifices God rejected or accepted. But we do know, and we're told, he did it by faith. And we also know that faith comes from what? Yeah, hearing the word of God. And so there were some commands. There were expectations that had been laid out. And well said, Abel is this proof that just because you offer God something, this doesn't mean that necessarily he accepts it. It has to be on his terms. And Abel shows the path to righteousness there. Very, very good. Other comments before we go on? Yes, please. And what well stated, yeah, the comment is that just because we offer something to God, God does not accept every sacrifice. It must be according to his will, according to his standards. Yeah, and it's like the verse we examined last night. Not everyone who says to me, Lord, Lord. Let's go on to the next figure in this hall of faith, so to speak. In verse 5, we see Enoch. Now here, what is the distinguishing characteristic of Enoch? So Abel offered and obtained witness that he was righteous. Enoch, what's said about him? He pleased God. Now, I want you to hold your place here, and let's turn back to Genesis chapter 5. And I want us to look back in Genesis 5 and see where we can find about Enoch pleasing God. So in chapter 5 of Genesis, we go on down through this genealogy of the family of Seth. And it says in verse 21, we're introduced to Enoch as he begins to beget. It says in verse 21, Enoch lived 65 years and begot Methuselah. After he begot Methuselah, Enoch walked with God 300 years and had sons and daughters. So all the days of Enoch were 365 years. In verse 24, Enoch walked with God, and he was not, for God took him. That's it. And he moves on. Wouldn't you like to know a little bit more about that? I would, but we're not given. We're given the important part that God wants us to know. Anything said here about God being pleased? So what do we assume then about how the Spirit wants us to think about Enoch's walking with God? This is synonymous with Enoch pleasing God. And we won't have the time to go into great detail about this, but I think it's very purposeful, the language that he walked with God. We'll see in the next chapter in Genesis that Noah walked with God. This becomes the formula for those who are accepted by God. And I think you go back to Genesis 3 with God walking through the garden. And the point being made is here are some individuals that understand what God's all about as creator. All right, the idea here is that Enoch embraced a relationship with his creator and acknowledged his laws. And the point going back to the book of Hebrews then is that Enoch, in this sinful series of generations, was capable of making the stand and taking the decisions to please God. And he then transitions, as we go back to Hebrews 11 and verse 6, he goes on to say, now that we're talking about pleasing God, without faith it is impossible to please him. What he goes on to say here in verse 6 is so crucial to the message of the book and for us. As he says, he who comes to God, number one, must believe that he is, and secondly, that he is a rewarder of those who diligently seek him. Now, to be sure, the idea here is not, now here we are, we've come up to God, and here we are before God. All right, now here I am before God, what do I got to do? Well, I got to believe that he is. Check. I got to believe he's a rewarder of those who seek him. Check. No, I don't think that's so much the idea of, now that you're here, here are some requirements. No, the idea is that if you are going to approach God in the first place, if you are going to seek him and to come before him, you must have this before you do it. This is what will motivate you to come before God. It is the faith that he is and that he rewards. And the point that he's making is that when you come to God and you are truly coming to him and seeking him, that demands sacrifice as a prerequisite to even approaching God and acknowledging him to seek him. You are giving up somewhat of self. And the idea is that you are becoming vulnerable. You are casting away the moorings that in the past that you have counted on for stability. And you are committing yourself to God and what he has in store for you. You're resting on his ability and will to reward. And so he is saying, dear Christian, you want to please the Father? Let go. Let go of the past. Let go of all that you found your life on and commit yourself to him. And you will not be left disappointed. He will return the investment that you make. Such a crucial lesson for those Christians and for us today. Can we go on to Noah then in verse 7? By faith, Noah, being divinely warned of things not yet seen, moved with godly fear, prepared an ark for the saving of his household, by which he condemned the world and became heir of the righteousness, which is according to faith. You know, the idea, as we see in Genesis 6, as God says, Noah, there's going to be a flood, and I'm going to wipe off the planet. You construct this ark, and you will save your family, because you found grace in my eyes. Had Noah seen a flood before? All right, according to this kind of scale and according to this means by which God would achieve it, things that not yet seen. So he did not have past experience. He had nothing in the natural world to rationalize the decisions that he was going to be making. And that's what faith calls upon us in this generation. Yes, we don't dispense with reason. We don't dispense with our understanding of the natural world. But that is not the lens through which we rationalize what we do in service to God. All right, it's faith that requires that. And as Noah moves with godly fear, he prepared the ark And notice, by which he condemned the world. Now, how did building an ark condemn the world? How does obeying God by faith today condemn the world? Okay. All right. So the idea is that by virtue of committing to this idea that there is salvation, what does that say on the other side? That there is condemnation. That there's another path that one could take and another end. Other thoughts on this, how Noah condemns the world, how the faithful can today. That's right. God gives us a choice, and by the choosing to serve him, there's the acknowledgement of standards. And what does that say about those who do not seek that standard? All right. And so with that said, again, the point to these to this audience, to these Christians and to us, your decisions draw a dividing line. Make sure you're on the right side of this dividing line. Let's go on then and turn to verses 8, and we will go ahead and pick up with verses 8 and go through 16 on the fathers, the patriarchs. It says in beginning in verse 8, "By faith Abraham obeyed when he was called to go out to the place which he would receive as an inheritance, and he went out not knowing where he was going. By faith he dwelt in the land of promise as in a foreign country, dwelling in tents with Isaac and Jacob, the heirs with him of the same promise. For he waited for the city which has foundations, whose builder and maker is God. By faith Sarah herself also received strength to conceive seed, and she bore a child when she was past the age, because she judged him faithful who had promised. Therefore from one man, and him as good as dead, were born as many as the stars of the sky in multitude, innumerable as the sand which is on the seashore, by the seashore. These all died in faith, not having received the promises, but having seen them afar off, were assured of them, embraced them, and confessed that they were strangers and pilgrims on the earth. For those who say such things declare plainly that they seek a homeland. And truly, if they had called to mind that country from which they had come out, they would have had opportunity to return. But now they desire a better, that is, a heavenly country. Therefore, God is not ashamed to be called their God, for he has prepared a city for them." Now, you go back and you look at what Abraham was willing to do. He obeyed when he was called to go out of his homeland, out of his country, and go to a place that he had never seen, and he never actually built any kind of permanent dwelling in that promised land. Now, can you not see the application for the Christians then? You have been called out of Judaism, your father's religion, your father's traditions, and you've been called to come out of that, and you may not always see in front of your feet, steps ahead, where you are going. But if you want to truly follow in the steps of your father Abraham, you will be like him, and you are willing to give that up and to move where God is leading you, even though you don't always see where that path is going to end. And that requires faith and seeing the end goal. And in verse 10, we're told why. Instead of tents, he was waiting for a city that God had built. And I want to make a few comments about that in just a minute, but I want to keep going on and just kind of say one word of application from learning from Sarah. She's remembered as being faithful by receiving the strength to do this. In chapter 16 of Genesis, what did Sarah do to help God along? Hagar, the handmaid, let's get an heir from him. Chapter 18, she laughs when she is given the promise. Can I say something here? And that is, our stories do not consist of just one single chapter or of my lowest moments. Faith can be the story of my life and can stand as a positive testament, and I can overcome moments of a lack of faith, and I can transition into being a positive example by faith. And so if you feel like there have been moments in your life when you haven't exactly covered yourself with glory, moments that you're ashamed of, moments that have demonstrated a lack of faith, you're alive. Your story's not done yet. Keep writing it like Sarah did, by faith. But go on to see then, as he moves to verses 13 through 16, the point being made throughout is these people were not focused upon the here and now, but they were able to look beyond and they understood that we don't belong here. You know, this makes me think of living in a foreign country, spending time in a foreign country, and that kind of dynamic. And it brings to life what is being said here. Many of you have probably had that experience as well, even if it's in another state to a degree. You know, a few years ago, I was able to visit Brazil and to do some work there. And while I was there in Brazil, you know, there were current events. There were things that happened in the country, political things. I was interested in them. But there was a point at the end of the day where that really didn't impact me because I was going to be going back to my homeland. And so I didn't concern myself about these things, okay? There were things that were going on in society, and I'm concerned about the spiritual state of those there, but the affairs of this country, I'm not its citizen. These aren't my problems, so to speak. And it's a relief when you understand that, yes, we are to be concerned about our fellow human beings, but for a Christian to be so absorbed about this world and the citizens of this age and era, to the degree that either suffocates and quells or stymies our enthusiasm for the world beyond and my citizenship in that spiritual kingdom, then I need to do some growing and to be thoughtful about my thoughts and my priorities. We don't belong here. I'm not going to fit in. This is not my home. And the idea is that God is in the process of preparing me for that spiritual citizenship. And the point of these patriarchs and fathers is that they demonstrate that from generation to generation, God has called upon his people, don't get too comfortable. And the reason why? I have so much better prepared for you. Begin living as citizens of the kingdom now so that you are fit and prepared for that eternal home. And how about verse 16? Can I read the end of that verse again? God is not ashamed to be called their God, for he has prepared a city for them. Not ashamed to be called their God. You know, there are some associations in this life that maybe we're not the happiest to be associated with. Things that cause us embarrassment just by association. To think that God can so help us and strengthen us so that he could look upon us and I'm not ashamed of them. Does that mean I'm going to be perfect? Does that mean, again, like we said before, that I'm going to unerringly follow this path of faith? The point being made here is look to the past. It's possible. You can be righteous. You can speak good things about God's plan. You can please God. You can make the tough decisions and sacrifices. It is doable, and you will be accepted if you will commit that to him. I want to go ahead and close then by looking at verses 17 through 22. Comments or anything that we need to add before we go on? Okay. So, verses 17 through 22. By faith, Abraham, when he was tested, offered up Isaac, and he who had received the promises offered up his only begotten son, of whom it was said, in Isaac your seed shall be called, concluding that God was able to raise him up, even from the dead, from which he also received him in a figurative sense. By faith, Isaac blessed Jacob and Esau concerning things to come. By faith, Jacob, when he was dying, blessed each of the sons of Joseph and worshipped, leaning on the top of his staff. By faith, Joseph, when he was dying, made mention of the departure of the children of Israel and gave instructions concerning his bones. A few lessons about faith here. Abraham, in being willing to offer up Isaac, and as the application for the Christians of that generation and now, Abraham was willing to give up that which was most valuable and precious to him, and even that which he had wrested the means by which God would bring about the promises. The idea here is that I don't understand God's ways. I cannot understand the rationale behind it. And I don't know what God has in store for the fulfillment of this. But at the end of the day, what does faith do? Faith acknowledges that there is one above me whose wisdom and whose care for me I cannot fathom. And he commits himself to him. And as he said here, he assumed that God could simply raise up from the remains of Isaac a promised son. In other words, Abraham's faith was such that he did not restrict God and God's potential. He did not put bounds around which God could do. And that's what faith requires of us now. But go on to read in verses 20, 21, 22. Isaac, Jacob, and Joseph. You know something all three of these mentions and references have in common? They all refer to end-of-life moments. And at the end of their life, at this moment of decision and the crisis of the end of life, they look forward to and they realize what I am a part of moves beyond me. And they are then transitioning then and passing that off to the next generation. And especially with Joseph here, as he acknowledged to his brethren and his family members, I don't belong in Egypt. And I know someday God will bring you out. He saw it as clear as day. And what a wonderful thing when we read then, finally, in the book of Joshua, as Joseph's remains are laid to rest. God keeps his word. So I want to close then by just stating, and they speak for themselves, points that I would say, how does chapter 11 then of Hebrews change me? And certainly there will be more things that you all have to say and need to say next time. But I'll go ahead and say a few things that we can already conclude. Number one, and that is, you have the option to go back, Christian. You can go back to the world. The path is there. The patriarchs knew the way back to Ur. But the idea is that they understood that that would also cost them something as well. You can go back, Christian. You can go back to the world, your former ways. But you have to think about what that's going to cost you. It is much more pricey than we can ever hope. A second point to be gained from Hebrews 11, and I think this is well established, but that is, faith is not passive. And this is a wonderful chapter for us to help our friends understand that faith is something that moves. Faith acts. And it's a wonderful study alongside James 2, isn't it? That faith without works is dead. The third and final point from Hebrews chapter 11 is this. Is that the end of time? All right, of my time this morning? Oh, here we go. All right. I thought I was cut off. All right. Faith creates a longing and a disquiet while we're here, such that can only be fulfilled when we rest in God. And in other words, these men and women that we read about, they were restless, in a sense. They never found it here. Now I want to say something. We're not meant to find our ultimate happiness and peace here. And if we feel like we've arrived at that, we've missed out on what is genuine. And we've been taken in with the imitation. We are restless here until finally our hearts rest in God. And that will finally come on the day of judgment that these all looked forward to. And as you will see then next time at the end of this chapter, all of these are just part of that great stream of salvation that we are a part of as well, by faith. Thanks for listening this morning and enjoyed the comments and the study.